Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm Dr. John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. With the economic downturn we've suffered through since 2008, mental health advocates have seen dramatic increases in stress-related conditions, including frank mental illness. The economy has played a role, to be sure, but some experts think that our wired, instant gratification society has led to greater stress and worse coping and parenting skills. Tulsa is no exception, even though we've been blessed with unemployment lower than the national average. My guest today, Gail Lapidus, is Chief Executive Officer of Family and Children's Services, which has been committed to providing mental health and social services to Tulsans in need since 1925. Lapidus has been with Family and Children since the 1970s, rising up the ranks to become Executive Director in 1986. Today we'll discuss her impressions of the mental health landscape in Tulsa and beyond, including a model innovative program to help women substance abusers reclaim their lives and get out of prison. Gail Lapidus, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you.
I'm glad you could be here. Gail Lapidus is the CEO of Family and Children's here in Tulsa. And I wanted to ask you, how long have you been in your role?
I've been in my role since 1986 as the CEO, but prior to that, I've been working for the agency since 1974. So that's a long time.
And how did you find your way to Tulsa?
Well, my family moved here from New York, and I graduated from high school, actually, at Memorial High School, wound up going to OU, School of Social Work, and came back and immediately started my first job right out of school as a social worker in Westside Housing Projects back in 74.
Wow. And how have things changed over the years? What would you say is the most prominent change that you've seen at Family and Children's?
Probably I think poverty has increased significantly. Complexity of family problems and different arrangement of families. And probably the most obvious thing is the growth of the Hispanic population in Tulsa, as well as the Vietnamese population from when I started in the community. But I just think that I've seen just a growing increase of violence. It was always here back in 74, but there's more of everything. There's more drug involvement. There's more drug abuse. There seems to be more violence, more child abuse, more everything that sort of fractures families and individual well-being. I sort of see both happening at the same time.
So is it that the problems themselves are growing, or is it that our awareness of them are growing as the scope and scale of Family and Children's has grown over the years?
Well, it's a good question, and I think it's both things, depending on which type of disorder or family problem we might want to look at. Like, for example, we've always had a very, very high divorce rate, one of the highest in the nation, and that has not really changed very much over the years. Our child abuse rates have soared over the years as the economy plummets and as there have been fewer resources available in a community. The rates of child abuse go up. And so we've seen definite rates in that. I know domestic violence has gone up considerably over the years in our community. Many people will equate the economy and poverty and stresses on family and ability to sort of get out and get a leg up to the rise in some of our social problems.
Can you share with me the scope of Family and Children's? How many families, how many lives in Tulsa City, Tulsa County, or Northeast Oklahoma are touched? And how do you frame your mission?
Okay, it's a good question. Our commitment to serving the poor and the uninsured has been the same since 1925. You know, that's sort of been our mission in the community, to strengthen families, to be the place that people can turn to for family services and mental health treatment, regardless of their ability to pay. And that's sort of our signature contribution we make to the city, that we're offering the capacity for people to become whole again, for families to become strengthened, for abused children to realize their full potential, even if they have no insurance or money. And that becomes my job, is to raise the money and make sure we have enough resources each year to serve all the people in need. The last year, we served 1 in 6 Metro Tulsans. It's a lot of people. And they come to us across the span of a lifetime, from very, very young children to seniors, although that's not one of our specialty areas. And we see people just like physicians. You see people with colds that have symptoms or maybe a small fever all the way up to pneumonia. And we're like that in the whole field of family difficulties or mental health. You can have mental health struggles, maybe first-time depression, anxiety, all the way down to the other end of the spectrum of severe mental illness, bipolar, major depression, schizophrenia, those types of illnesses that wreak havoc in a person's functioning and in their life. We see children, and many of them in our community, with a host of problems. And I'd be happy to sort of talk a little bit about that if you'd like me to go on that area.
Yeah, actually I would. If you'd be willing to share a story or two or perhaps more of the trend, I'd like to hear it.
Sure. I think one of the things that is most troubling in our agency is we see a significant large number of the children who are sexually abused in our community. And it's quite a bit. We're serving about 950 children who have either been sexually abused or traumatized in some significant way. And the realization that you can make such a difference in repairing their broken and hurt world is, I think, what keeps the core of the agency alive, as there's been more and more information coming from the medical field and the scientific discovery about really what trauma does to a human being at childhood and how does that even affect that one human being's life and their health and their well-being and their mental health over their lifetime, knowing that we can sort of interrupt a pattern of dysfunction across all of that sort of inspires a lot of our staff to make sure that we are available for every abused child to get treatment. So our average child right now in the sexual abuse treatment program is probably under 9 years old. Most of the families that we see, the abuse happened by somebody they know, typically a family member or could be an extended family member, maybe, or a boyfriend of somebody that has been sexually abusing the children, sometimes in heinous and horrific ways that make it in the newspaper. Sometimes in a one-time event might happen as opposed to over a child's lifetime of many years. So we have children that will come out after they complete the program, which can take upwards to a year or longer before they would claim themselves that they have fully restored the event where they feel empowered and beyond the trauma and as a whole person again. And that's probably the most delightful of all the work that we do is being able to see the children have a fresh start again.
And how does Family and Children's receive cases, so to speak? I mean, this sounds to be a growing and terrible problem. Are these cases that are referred in from mental health professionals in the community or pediatricians or, you know, law enforcement?
A combination from all of the above, including self-referrals. There's sometimes a little child will come home from, say, a visit and tell their parent that they were hurt when they were over at so-and-so's house over the weekend. This person touched me here. This person did this to me. And so sometimes it's the self-revelation of the child themselves. We get a lot of referrals from schools, school nurses, school counselors, teachers, where they notice a child sobbing in the back of the classroom. They're reluctant and hesitant to tell the teacher what happened. And eventually they might call the Department of Human Services and us at the same time to make sure that they can hook the family up with help. So we're very connected to the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Group, who refers many of those cases to us for ongoing treatment, but it doesn't have to come in the door that way. So I'm always surprised at how many different groups of referral sources we have on the issue of abuse. And of course, doctors, attorneys, judges, the Child Abuse Network, the other agencies in town, pediatricians, of course.
So you mentioned the long span of your career at Family and Children's. How has the organization grown in terms of dollars and in terms of employees over those decades?
It's grown quite a bit. When I became the executive director in 1986, I think we had 50 employees with a budget of, I don't know, a few million dollars. And now our budget is over $40 million, our annual operating budget, and we have over 500 employees. So we've grown quite a bit to keep up with the community need. And the only thing that we've really done different is continue to expand our behavioral health services to different and unique populations. But that's pretty much what we do. Our core business is still that.
And you referred to the down economy being particularly troubling in terms of mental health for the community. What about in your role as CEO with fundraising? Is it obviously more challenging in a down economic environment, or have you been able to sustain your budget at its current levels or grow it along with the needs in the community?
We've been lucky. Tulsa, as you know, is a very generous community and has a heart for both children's issues and mental health issues. It comes from a lot of philanthropists in our community that have given voice to this issue, so it's well known and well supported. So we have to work hard every year like everybody else to make our case for the needs of the population that we're serving, but we've been able to be very successful with our fundraising effort as well as securing several very big national research grants in order to extend our services through some federal dollars that we've been able to achieve, as well as we get a significant amount of money from the Tulsa Area United Way locally and from the State Department of Mental Health that funds our core mental health services for adults.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Gail Lapidus, CEO of Family and Children's Services here in Tulsa. And I wanted to ask what you would like to see in terms of mental health resources available for your clients once they are perhaps either in treatment at Family and Children's or once they go beyond Family and Children's. In other words, back to normal life, what kinds of additional resources would you like to see them have or would be optimal in terms of mental health? Mm-hmm. I know in my practice, I see a high burden of mental illness here amongst Tulsans. And I sometimes feel like I'm a little bit resource constrained in terms of community mental health resources.
Mm-hmm. And we see, again, both mental health issues with a co-occurring substance abuse or another type of addiction. So sometimes the stressors in life, of which many people have many, wind up where people self-medicate, start with one drink or one set of pills, and before you know it, a broad sweeping addiction takes over. So we're also seeing people with both types of problems, which is very, very complicated to treat, and it's difficult for the individual and the family. Because we are not just a medically based mental health center and we are a social work organization, we are luckier than many medical care practices in which we do have linkages and relationships to find food, clothing, to get people housing. We provide transportation, we provide bus tokens. So we do spend a significant amount of our resources trying to wrap around all of those other services that you just mentioned. And for many low-income families that have no insurance and have mental health problems, they really struggle with meeting basic needs and where they're going to get their next meal from or how they're going to get four kids on a bus to school. So we see that over and over again, just the effect that being low income without a car, without a phone, without enough resources, it just wears individuals and families down.
I imagine over the span of your career, you've had many high moments, but also many low ones. I was wondering if you'd share with our listeners perhaps a story of inspiration or something that's moved you, or perhaps a time when something didn't go so well, either at the agency or with a client from way back when you started?
Oh, that's a big question. When I was a worker myself, I could tell you countless stories of success. And it was that original work I did when I was just in my 20s with so many low-income children and families that served as my inspiration for the rest of my entire career. I learned at a very young age that sometimes people can accomplish so much with just a little amount of help if you truly care about them and deliver the right service for them. And so many people are sort of isolated out there and don't know how to get help. And it doesn't always take that much to get a resounding success at the other end of somebody's life. I'm sitting here now remembering probably a very important day in the state of Oklahoma, and I was probably never more proud to be the head of Family and Children's Services, was during the Oklahoma City bombing. And I would say within 10 minutes of us getting the news, which I think we got over the news, every clinician that worked at the organization had volunteered to drive down the turnpike and just be there to see what they could do to help, to offer themselves up in whatever way. I stayed behind. I didn't go into the zone of help and support, but pretty much my entire clinical staff did. And I would say that probably sits with me as one of the most special days of my career. These people just were willing to use their talents without really being asked for. We were there before there was anything really organized, and that comes from this incredible commitment, I think, that our staff have in being willing to sort of step out of comfort zone offices, and whether it was going to the front lines in Oklahoma City or being out in the community in homeless areas, et cetera, to reach out for people in need.
That's an moving
story.
It
was a great day. It was a great day for pride of knowing that we had this incredible group of professionals.
You referred earlier to special populations that Family and Children's is now able to serve, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. Are you talking about special cultural populations? You mentioned before Vietnamese or Spanish-speaking clients. Is that something mm-hmm. that you're able to cater to with, you know, culturally specific and language-sensitive therapy?
We try. Yes, the answer is yes and not enough, because the growth of the Spanish-speaking population has outstripped professionals in our community that are Hispanic or Spanish-speaking. So we are always sort of, I think, still behind the curve, but working toward it. And what I also meant is I have worked very, very hard to make sure that our services are not only offered inside our facilities, but are out in the community to help people that typically would not know how to reach out for help. So, for example, I have two people that sit in the booking office of the Tulsa County Jail, and they're full-time employees of ours that sit there to assess for mental health needs, high risk, or individuals that maybe could be moved into a different level of care, and it was mostly their mental health that caused the problem that led them into the jail. I also have people that are working in the downtown courthouse, because we pull apart families on the family divorce floor, and many of them are in shock and are not exactly sure how they're going to get their life back in order and how to go on from there. So we have a team of professionals that are actually housed up there to reach out to those individuals to give them resources, support, referrals, and connect them with community needs. And those are just two of many, many examples where we're outstationed into different resources in the community.
Well, having that available right in the community at the point or the location of greatest need seems very smart in terms of your planning. I wonder, too, about something in your line of work, because you talked at the outset about how much the needs have grown, how much of the population you serve, which is absolutely tremendous, but then that these sort of difficult problems in terms of mental health, mental illness, child abuse, sexual abuse seem to have become more prevalent in society. I wonder about the people that work for you and burnout, actually, because when you're dealing with such difficult social and psychological situations, there inevitably comes a time where you're faced with the horror of humanity at some points. How do you keep your employees resilient?
Well, I think we are successful with some and not with everybody. I think people that are working with children who have been abused over and over again, they probably burn out the fastest, because dealing with any victim who's had such severe trauma, you can have sort of vicarious trauma experience yourself, the provider. So we do provide care to make sure that those issues are addressed, which is just anybody in our field would have to go through. And I think if you were to go into my agency today and interview our professionals, they would say the thing that burns them out more is not seeing the pain and despair of the lives of the people we treat, because they see such power and resilience also in those individuals, but in the systems that were designed to help people that beat people down. And I think those are the issues that probably work the hardest against professional resiliency. So when you're trying to get somebody who's finally on their feet, they've overcome their addiction, but now they can't get a job because they have a record, or somebody who is trying to get their kids back, but they can't get a house, or they can't get an apartment that satisfies the standards because there aren't enough of them, say, in our community. So we're a very rich, resourceful city on some levels, but there are still so many people that live at the margins of it and just find it difficult to take their individual steps they've made for their own progress, development, or recovery and move up into the next level, because it is so hard to do that.
Have there been points at which it or I guess my question is, has that changed? Have there been points at which it's been easier to help people get back on their feet with other resources? You mentioned employment as being one, or housing as being, I know from my work that those are key determinants of a person's overall health, those social determinants. Is it more challenging now? The same level of challenging? Are there ways in which we could make it easier?
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks to our partnership with the Mental Health Association of Tulsa, who took it upon themselves to really try to eradicate homelessness, you know, they've added a whole cohort of different apartments that are available. And so we have specific relationships with that organization in order to provide housing, because we're sort of serving the same population. We provide the treatment for the mentally ill, and they provide a lot of the housing. So that resource has made a huge, very noticeable, definable difference just in the last couple of years.
Going back to the population question about populations that you serve, do you know of any populations that you'd like to serve that you're not able to reach at this point? And by that, I mean, are there rural communities or places that you know there's a burden of illness in the community where you're just not able to make inroads at any point? Or I guess what I'm asking is, are there pockets of resistance, as it were, to your services?
You know, it's sort of interesting. That's probably, you know, one of the things that always surprises me the most when you talk about stigma of getting help, whether it's for mental illness or a marriage problem or a family problem. We don't seem to have that problem. We always have more people reaching out to us than we have the capacity to serve. So the answer is yes. I think we could be doing much, much more if we had more resources. So in some ways, we limit how far we can extend ourselves outside of the Tulsa metro area. We are in Owosso, Broken Arrow, and Claremore, but not further out than that. And we've sort of stuck to this geographic area because we haven't yet been able to fulfill, you know, our mission here. So we don't have plans to move much past that perimeter around Tulsa.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Gail Lapidus, CEO of Family and Children's here in Tulsa. She's been that since 1986 and been working with Family and Children since 1974, so is a major Tulsa institution in her own right. Gail, you mentioned before the ID that there are other communities out there that you'd like to extend to. And I guess my question is, where do you see Family and Children's in 5 years, or where would you like it to be? What's your vision for who else you could be serving, or how you would grow the organization, or how you would better serve the community?
I think, you know, some of the next phase is going to be more of an integration phase with other organizations. So say, for example, the entire field of mental health is changing dramatically around the United States, in which psychiatry and the treatment of a mental illness was kept very, very separate from their physical illness. And we now know that the two are very connected, and people with severe mental illness struggle with a whole range of really difficult medical conditions. And because most of the clients we see are poor and uninsured, they don't really get the help they need. So we're now piloting several programs, and I imagine they will grow significantly, partnering with medical organizations like Morton, like OU, in order to provide more medical care for our consumers that we're treating with mental illness. I think that's going to grow more and more. As one example, I think we're going to continue growing our services of working with children that have more serious and complex emotional disorders in an outpatient setting. Family and Children's has always been committed to keeping people in the least restricted environment, preferably home, and not in other places of living. So I think we're going to be working a lot on that, and we'll continue to keep responding to the Hispanic community's needs as it is projected to grow quite a bit over the next 10 years in Tulsa.
Gail, I want to ask you about one of the programs that has received a lot of press here in Tulsa, and that's the Women in Recovery program. Mm-hmm. How did you get that inspiration? How did it come about? Tell our listeners about, you know, who it serves and what the purpose of it is.
Okay, be happy to. Women in Recovery is our agency's probably newest and most well-known program. It serves women who were involved in nonviolent crimes, most in particular involved methamphetamine, which is a very large drug of choice in Tulsa, Oklahoma, one of the largest sort of areas that enjoy methamphetamine. And many of these women were facing anywhere from 1 to 20 years to life in prison. And it was a growing problem in that Oklahoma had the highest rate of female incarceration over any other state in the United States, which is a very horrific problem to have another really bad mark on Oklahoma. So the George Kaiser Family Foundation decided that they were going to make this an area because it was such a statistical outlier. Like, why would Tulsa, Oklahoma, or Oklahoma in general have such a high rate, so statistically higher than any other state, too? It was very, very bad. So it took many, many years of trying to work behind the scenes to try to understand the problem and figure out points of intervention. The foundation partnered with Family and Children's Services to see if we could research and find any kind of program around the United States that we could maybe emulate to try to intervene in this particular area. We found one in Manhattan. The director of that program came in and talked with the judges and lawyers and DAs in our community to try to understand and advise of what we could do. So an agreement was made to pilot a small program at first in which the district attorney's office, the public defender's office, the judges all had to agree that they would be willing to give this woman a chance instead of sending her to prison to send her to this program. And now we have, it's I think 18 months old now, our program, and we have, now see, it still seems like a baby, but I think it's maybe 3 years old now, although it feels like it was just yesterday. We have 100 women, active women in the program today. Combined, there's over 300 children involved with the program, all of whom would be right now sitting in prison with their children being traumatized without having their mom. It's an amazing program. We're getting fantastic results of being able to treat the trauma, treat the addiction, and find other ways of supporting these women to become whole again and become tax-paying corporate citizens, good moms, great working professionals to make contributions to the community. And because it's so holistic and comprehensive, it takes a year. It's a day treatment program. They're with us almost for a whole year, all day. They sleep in their own places at night. We have transportation to pick them up. But the program not only has very intense state-of-the-art addiction treatment and trauma treatment, but it provides GED training, food, clothing, shelter, transportation, health care, dental care, as well as volunteer community service. So these women get whole again. They return and get reunited with their children, start paying taxes instead of using taxpayer dollars in prison, and are just these beautiful, talented, resilient persons that really inspire anybody who meets them. I'd love for you to come up and meet some of them sometime and or volunteer some of your doctor services to them. They'd probably love that too.
That is truly an inspirational story, and congratulations on being so successful with that. I want to thank you for coming in and being on Studio Tulsa. We're out of time, but thank you, Gail Lapidus, the CEO of Family and Children's here in Tulsa. Thank you very much for coming
by.
Thank
you, John. I appreciate being invited.
Gail Lapidus has been the executive director and now CEO of Family and Children's Services in Tulsa since 1986. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you weren't able to catch today's or any of our programs, you can stream our audio or hear archive shows at publicradiotulsa.org. The views expressed on this program are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher.